Well, the magnificent image that we see in Daniel, chapter 2, reveals the kingdom of men that would follow the great Babylon, and under whom God's people, the nation of Israel, would find themselves in bondage. And this fine metallic figure, powerful and upright, splendid figure of a man, reflected the psyche of the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, that great warrior who'd torn through the land, vanquishing the countries all about him. But Babylon was destined to suffer the same humiliating defeat it had inflicted on others, and that same type of rapacious and cruel and power-hungry ambition would fuel other despots to do exactly what Nebuchadnezzar had done. And therefore, I think the human aspect of Daniel's image reflects the tyrannical nature of all subsequent tyrants. Now, the actual time period we'll be covering today is often referred to as the silent years, between the Old and the New Testament. And it includes the belly and the thighs of brass, which we believe to be the Greek Empire. That period of time from about 333 BC to 63 BC. Today we hope to get to about 161 BC, so we're not trying to do the lot. Now, what do we mean by silent years? We mean that there is absolutely no record of divine revelation or divine intervention by God to his people during this period. There was no prophet in Israel, no inspired writings by God, no one to encourage or to admonish the people. They were left in their captivities under the control of foreign powers, and in terms of spirituality, they were really left to their own devices. And we're going to see just what havoc they got up to. But silence doesn't mean idle. God was not idle. He may not have communicated with his people directly, but we hope to show you really how very busy he was during this time in preparing the world for the advent of his son, the only one through whom hope for all the world would come. Now, the curtains of the Old Testament, they fall on an ancient and an eastern world where Israel remained under the imperial reign of Persia. It's a type of world, I think, of belonging to sort of Alibaba and mystical and magic carpets, intriguing harems and turbans and all that type of stuff. Yes, the Jews had been allowed to return to Jerusalem, that is, those who wanted to. There wasn't many, apparently. The temple had been restored, although not to its former glory. The Aaronic line of priests was functioning again and overseeing the rituals of the law. But Israel was still a puppet nation under the control of Persia, and there was no king on the throne of Israel, despite the fact that Zerubbabel was the apparent heir. The religion of Israel, which had always been subject to the influences of nations and notions, was essentially that which was believed by the holy men of old. Yes, there was hypocrisy and ignorance and pride and disobedience. We know that from Malachi. And God was not pleased with them. But the essential doctrine that God is one, the promises to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, the promise that God would give them the land, the resurrection of the dead and the coming of Messiah to set up the kingdom was basically intact. But when the curtains rise on the New Testament, we're in another world. It's a Western world, and it's by comparison a modern world, a more democratic world. It was a Roman world. But the children of Israel are still a puppet nation. But this time they're under Rome. And in Palestine there is a king on the throne of Israel, a descendant of Esau. His name is Herod the Great. But this time, by this time actually, many of the priests are unable to trace their line back to Aaron. And the office of the high priest has become more political than religious. The temple, which had always been the centre of Jewish worship, had been replaced by synagogues that had spread throughout the land. There are Pharisees and there are Sadducees. Where do they come from? There are Essenes. Many of the Jewish people believed by this stage in Hades and demons and immortal souls, and I hope to show you that later. The Jewish teachers were corrupt and ignorant and impotent in their duties. The people were without spiritual guidance and laboured under the cruel master of Rome. How did all this happen in just over 400 years? Well, that's our mission for today. It's an enormous subject, impossible to cover in the short period, so we're just going to try and whet our appetites by having a brief look at the military history of Israel during the Greek period, the Persian legacy, because you don't go to bed Persian one night and make way about Greek the next. The influence of Greek culture on the Jewish people, how God prepared the world for the coming of Jesus, and light at the end of the tunnel. What moral lesson can we gain from these considerations and implement in our lives today in the 21st century? So, history. Okay, here we go. Great, that's a good... fantastic. Okay. It's so dry, you know. And I thought about how I could... I thought about how could I make this section more interesting whilst... You know, because it's boring, but it's really relevant, because if we're going to know how they came from Persia to Greece, to Rome, we've got to know how it happened. So what I've done is I've prepared a PowerPoint presentation of the main historical events that occurred during this period and that impacted on the Jews. And obviously this is a serious subject, but I hope to inject into it some lightheartedness that will make it more palatable. And if we find it hard to absorb the historical facts, perhaps we can remember the pictures. That's how I feel anyway. So here goes. At the end of the Old Testament... at the end of the Old Testament, we leave Israel under the control of Persia. During this period... I think I'm... Yes. Hang on, I've done that. Okay. Yeah. During... Isn't she gorgeous?
You got the wrong bits, maybe.
Some of the Jews had returned to Jerusalem, but it appears that most of them had remained very comfortably ensconced in Persia. That's three, four. There's... something's gone wrong with this. Four. Here we go. But at the height of Persian supremacy, the prophecy that we read about in Daniel 8 came to pass. And Alexander the Great, with the unified Greek nation, streaked from the west and won a tremendous battle against the Persians, completely demolishing the Persian army. And in that terrible but decisive battle, the centre of world power changed from east to west. The Greek period was now the prevailing world power. The leopard of Daniel 7 had devoured the bear. And it's funny, isn't it, how what men see as a fine, upright, metallic, beautiful warrior, God sees as a pack of devouring, unclean animals. Mm. It's the same picture, yeah. Different perspectives. Mm. But there is one significant difference between the belly of brass, or the leopard of Daniel 7, or the goat of Daniel 8, each one representing Alexander the Great and his empire. There's one difference between this kingdom and the others, that is Babylon, Persia and Rome. Can anyone tell me what they think it might be? Any thoughts?
What's the question again?
There's something different about the Greek period in the Bible as compared to Babylon, Persia and Rome.
They
weren't
governing. Oh! Oh, really?
Yeah. There's nothing in the scriptures that ever recorded it happened.
Goodness.
It's predicted. It's prophesied.
Because we read, will say it, but not.
Yes. We can read about in Daniel. We can read about Darius, and then we can read about Xerxes and Xerxes in Nehemiah, and we can read about Caesar in all the Caesars in the New Testament. But there is nothing that records the Greek Empire actually came to pass in the Bible. And for information, then we are reliant, heavily reliant, on Josephus. That's the Greek, the Jewish historian, who is not always the most reliable of sources because he's not terribly objective at times.
Mm.
A few Greek texts and some references made by some Latin scholars. Because we as Bible enthusiasts focus a lot on Palestine, but in the big picture of world dominion at that time, the land we know as Israel was relatively insignificant, and it was a smaller country inhabited by odd people with strange customs and beliefs, more annoying than influential. Yeah. And there's just one other point I would like to make about the Greek Empire. It didn't start with Alexander, something which, you know, we've got to get that in the head because I always thought, oh, that was it. But the Greek people, they went back at least 800 years before this. And it was not as if the Greeks had not had conflict with Persia before this. In fact, history tells us of some monumental battles. You know the one about Marathon? That all took part.
Mm.
But for centuries, the people of Greece had managed to stave off the Persians' attempt to incorporate them into the empire. And during this time, Greek people, although not a world empire, nevertheless lived independently and productively, and unknowingly set in motion ideas and ideologies which would have an impact on the next 2,500 years of history in which we even have today in our society, Western societies. It was during this pre-Alexander period, which is known as the Classical Greek period, spanning from about 500 to 333 BC, that democratic government became fully developed. The Parthenon on Acropolis Hill was built, and many of the famous schools of philosophy were founded. But the Greeks had never enjoyed world dominion, and the main reason for that was that they were actually scattered over a large area in lots of little cities and islands, and they were always warring with one another. So it wasn't until Philip of Macedon waged war with the various Greek cities that he eventually overthrew Athens, which was the chief one, and he united a fragmented people under his sovereignty in around about the 350s BC. And it was this that paved the way for his son, Alexander, to amass a Greek army, a unified Greek army, into an efficient war machine that tore across the land, conquering Europe, Asia, Egypt, Africa, and successfully establishing the largest empire in the ancient world to date. Now, paramount in Alexander's conquest was Persia, which he defeated in a decisive battle. It was known as the Battle of Gaugamela on the Persian plains, where over 30,000 Persians died in one day. So this Alexander became known, as we all know, as Alexander the Great, although he was called Alexander the Accursed to his enemies. So the fall of the Persian Empire hailed the Hellenistic period of Greek history, and it's this period that is depicted in the brazen belly of Nebuchadnezzar's image. And it is so named Hellenistic because it was a time when not only the Greek military but Greek culture and Greek philosophy infiltrated and captivated the entire world. And the Jews, some who had returned to the land and many more who were scattered throughout the communities, became victims of a new master Greek. Now, Josephus tells a really interesting story about Alexander the Great. I don't know whether it's true or not, but apparently, there's old Alexander the Great. Apparently, this is the story. About 1 year after the destruction of Persia, Alexander was on his way down to visit Egypt, the country he'd captured from Persia 10 years before the final defeat. And he decided as he was passing by Jerusalem, well, I might as well pop in there and see what loot I can get. However, the high priest at the time, a man named Jada, took the sacred writings of Daniel and, accompanied by a group of priests dressed in white, went out to meet Alexander before he entered the city. Now, it so happened that Alexander the night before had had a dream that portrayed a man in white showing him something of great significance, right? So upon meeting up with each other, the priest proceeded to show Alexander from the prophecy the description of himself. And Alexander was so impressed with the accuracy of this prophecy, he promised to spare Jerusalem, and he sent back the priests to Jerusalem, where they were welcomed with much joy and jubilation. Now, whether this is true or false or enhanced, we don't know, but it must be noted that Alexander never attacked Jerusalem, and he allowed the laws that had been established there by the Persians centuries before to remain, and he also gave the Jews some special privileges, such as not paying tribute every 7 years. So that's just a thought of quite interesting. Some historians say, well, that's just because Jerusalem wasn't worth capturing at the time. But anyway, I don't know. However, the glorious he-goat, he came to an untimely end in about 323 BC, when he died of alcoholic poisoning, so they say, at about 33 years of age, leaving no heir, as his only son had been murdered earlier. And so what happened? The empire was divided among the four generals, or the four horns of the prophecy. And after a great deal of infighting over a period of 7 to 20 years, two of these generals prevailed to be independent forces. There they are. One was Ptolemy. I can't say that properly, but I think that's how you say it.
Ptolemy.
Who went south, and he took control of Egypt and some of the northern countries of Africa. But included in his conquest was the land of Palestine, where the Jews suffered terribly under his control. And the other prevailing general was Seleucia, who took control of the northern areas above Syria. So Greece was now a divided kingdom, albeit under the umbrella of the Greek Empire. Now, there were attempts during the next 100 years to try and unite them, mainly through marriage, and there's some pretty yucky stories about that, but I don't think we've got the time to go into it. Yeah. Now, I want you to hold up your hands like that. Yeah, I want you to imagine that this is the Northern Kingdom, and that's the Southern Kingdom, that's the Mediterranean Sea, and that's the desert, right? The problem with Palestine was its location. Mm. The location of Palestine had always been a problem because it sat right in the passageway between north and south. So every time a power from the north waged war against a power from the south, or vice versa, which historically was quite often, the little land of Israel that housed the city of Jerusalem became a pathway for the armies and a pawn in the battle, like two bullies fighting over a ball. So, now, of special interest to us is the rise of a king in the north, about 203 BC, from the Seleucian power base named Antiochus the Great. He decided to grab Jerusalem from the control of Ptolemy in Egypt. Ptolemy in Egypt. And after a period of bloodthirsty warfare, he successfully conquered Jerusalem, heralding in the reign of the Syrian rule over Palestine. And this guy had two sons who succeeded him, and the second son took over the throne when his brother died, and his name was Antiochus Epiphanes. And he was a vicious and a violent persecutor of the Jews, and he set his mind to enforce the Jews to abandon their religion and embrace Greek culture. Well, he modestly called himself Antiochus the Illustrious. But some of his opponents changed two letters in his name to read Epiphanes instead of Epiphanes, which means more appropriately madman. Now, whilst Jerusalem had suffered at times harshly under Ptolemy. They had at least been allowed to practice their religion, even if the high priest had been made to collect taxes for the Ptolemy's treasure chests. Now, the first attack of Antiochus against the Jews was to savagely remove the legitimate high priest, a man named Onias the Third. And accomplishing this brutal act, he brought to an end a line of over 1,000 years of high priest successions from Aaron. And he didn't stop there, so let's take the priest away. Realising that if he controlled the office of high priest, he could control the people, he put the position of high priest up for the highest bidder.
Oh.
And it was Jason. And it was Jason, the brother of Onias, who saw the potential for personal advantages if he was willing to compromise and accommodate Antiochus. So Jason stole the priesthood from his brother by being the highest bidder. But another brother, Menelaus, he outbid his brother. So Jason was thrown off the high priest's throne and Menelaus was given the job of high priest. The problem was, 1 year later, Menelaus was unable to pay the bribe that he promised. So he started selling the temple's gold utensils to raise money to pay off his debt to Epiphanes. So, just to get the order, Onias' brother Jason bribes Epiphanes, then he gets outbidded, Menelaus is unable to pay his debt, so he steals the temple treasures to cover his debt. And then Onias, that's the good priest that had originally been thrown off the throne, he went to his brother to rebuke him for his wickedness, and this is what happened. Onias had his brother murdered. Now, I made it dramatic because what I want to show you is this is Jew against Jew. This is brother against brother. Antiochus was indeed a madman, but what does it make this lot? But it doesn't end there. Jason, angry for having been dumped in favour of his brother, then gathered an army to fight against Menelaus in an effort to regain the office of high priest. And in an ironic situation, Antiochus Epiphanes was forced to come down to Jerusalem to break up this brotherly war and defend Menelaus because he's the one that promised him the most money. And what we're really showing here is it goes to show us how much power and control could be wielded in the position of high priest, and these brothers would stop at nothing to get it. And the savagery continues because Epiphanes banned the law of Moses, circumcision, even murdering some of the mothers who had their baby boys circumcised. Now, 1 year later, which is around about 171 BC, Antiochus again invaded Egypt, and once again, Israel's caught in the middle. But on this occasion, Antiochus was reported to have been murdered in Egypt. And when the Jews heard of his death, there was great rejoicing, there was great celebrations, and they overthrew the rogue priesthood, in celebrations. But the sad thing was it was a false alarm because he hadn't been killed. Right. And as retribution, he furiously, furiously attacked Jerusalem, intruding into the temple and trashing the most holy place. He destroyed the holy scrolls, and to the horror of the Jews, he took a pig and he offered it on the sacred altar in honour of Zeus. And about 40,000 Jews died in a 3-day massacre. So appalled were the Jews at this act of sacrilege. Disgust and anger fueled a Jewish priest called Judas Maccabeus, who with his sons rallied the Jews to revolt against the Syrian king. And implementing today what we would probably call guerrilla warfare, they reclaimed Jerusalem and reinstituted temple worship in exactly 6.5 years or 2,300 days from the day it had been defiled by Antiochus Epiphanes. And this event is still celebrated by the Jewish people today, and it's called Hanukkah on the 25th of December. So began a period of relative peace which the Jews remember today. But it was during this time of peace that the Jews made a pact with a rising military power in the West by signing a treaty on behalf of the Jews that in case of further attacks by Syria, the emerging Roman army would come to their rescue. Thus Israel invited what would be their next oppressor into their history. Hadn't they learnt their lesson yet? That their defence lay with God, not a Roman general. Anyway, I'm going to leave the history at that point because it's the beginning of the Maccabean story and our next lot of speakers is going to take it up from there. What I want to say is, in summary, we've seen, in just a short overview, we only went into the main things, 200 years or so of a terrible history of violence, treachery, murder, humiliation, as the Jewish people became victims of a long line of rapacious and cruel tyrants both within the nation and within the empire. We see division within the empire and the nation. We see the violent end of the Aaronic priesthood. We see the fulfilment of Daniel 8. And if history can show us anything at all, it can show us how very much the people of God urgently needed their Redeemer. Okay, I just want to talk briefly, because I know Rosemary, I listened to the tape from last session, briefly mentioned this. But what about the effects these changes and times had on the psyche of the people? What impact did these changing cultures have on the Jewish people? We know from the Old Testament how very vulnerable they were to foreign influences. Right from the beginning, they wanted a king like everybody else. And the prophets are full, they're full of appeals to turn from copying or polluting their worship with the customs of foreign gods. So what happened to them when there was no prophet in Israel to prod their moral conscience? What happened when the unique ritual of Jewish worship and religion, which so defined their identity as Jews, and kept them separate from others, was no longer available, when their temple was destroyed, their rituals and feasts no longer possible? Well, back in Persia, when Cyrus overthrew Babylon and the Jews had a new master, as Ro told us last time, they didn't do too badly. Cyrus was, by all accounts, a good king, a ruler who even today is recognised and remembered for his humanity and benevolence. But what inspired him? What inspired him to be this nice guy in an otherwise quite barbaric world? And I'm going to suggest to you that the answer probably lies in the fact that he was an adherent of the ancient Persian religion called Zoroastrianism, which is often called God-worshipping. Now, I just want to spend a few minutes on this and then we'll go, because I know you've actually done some of it. That's the Persian exit. I had fun with this. Okay. So I've just briefly put down some of the beliefs of it. On this side here, this is what they believe. There's only one God who is the source of light. God has an evil opponent, but man has free will. Where men's souls spend eternity is determined by their behaviour. There are various departments in the afterworld depending on your level of goodness or badness. God has no images nor requires no temples. Man will be judged on his deeds, whether he's done evil or good. At death, a person's soul descends to a waiting room where he'll be met by a beautiful maiden if he's been good, or an old hag. There will come a time when all the souls will be resurrected at judgment. The bad will return to the place of darkness forever. And anyway, it's all there. So we've got that there. Okay. It's widely acknowledged by scholars that this religion had major influences on Islam, Judaism and Christianity, and you can see why. And for the Jews who are living comfortably in a Persian world without religious structure, it's easy to see how that they could identify with some of these beliefs and how that over time even adopts, excuse me, some of them into their own thinking. And I hope to show you that's exactly what happened. But just as a matter of interest, just as a sideline, how did Cyrus manage to maintain his monotheistic belief and yet accommodate the many gods of the polytheistic nations around about him? Well, he actually simply conceived the other gods were messengers of either the good god or his opponent. And then he divided these messengers into good or bad categories. Now, he thought that the god of the Jews, Yahweh, was a good god. And it was for this reason he generously allowed the Jews to return to the place where their god lived, which was Jerusalem, to rebuild his temple. The return to Jerusalem by the Jews was not Cyrus simply saying, it's nice, you can go home now. From his point of view, it was encouraging and authorising a religious pilgrimage, a good deed. And it was by this means that God used Cyrus to fulfil his prophecy that the Jews could return to their homeland. But only about 45,000 went, I think. The rest remained throughout the communities of Persia for the next few hundred years. Now, the Jewish people have a remarkable ability to blend into a culture, to take from that environment the things that would benefit them, yet at the same time maintain their Jewish identity. But whilst their identity would remain intact, their thinking and their lifestyles were influenced by the people with whom they lived. And in summary, what I'm thinking the Persian legacy is, was the infiltration into Jewish beliefs of some ideas that are closely aligned to Zoroastrianism. And so into the Greek world went the Jews with a compromised belief system and a vulnerability for further corruption. I thought that was quite interesting, actually. So our next little bit is the influence of Greek philosophy and culture on the Jews. That's the Olympic Games. No civilization has had a greater impact on the world than that of Greece. Even today, the Greek legacy can be seen in our political systems, our law, our philosophies, even our scriptures. Alexander's empire was vast. It stretched from Egypt to India. It was a huge united landmass. And he built in it multiple cities. Some people say up to 20 cities. And he called them all Alexandria. It's a bit strange, isn't it? The most famous one is the one, of course, in Egypt. And into these cities came Greeks, settlers, who then spread the Greek culture, the Greek language, architecture, philosophy, everything like that. And in so doing, the pathways across the empire were being tracked, which were actually the forerunners of the Roman roads. Now, the Greeks are attributed to introducing the idea that the human being is the centre of all things. And this today we know as the doctrine of humanism. They espouse the idea that the mind has the ability to understand all things rationally. And their concept of mind and matter and rationale and action would and still can have an impact on how some concepts in the New Testament are interpreted. They're great philosophers like Hippocrates, Plato, Aristotle, Archimedes, Socrates were considered to have great minds and thoughts that could enlighten all mankind. They were what we would be, what could call universalists. They were open to new ideas from wherever they came from. They enjoyed thinking outside of the square. They aspired to wisdom. They believed they'd acquired it. In short, the Greeks believed their nation was the pinnacle of all civilizations, and their intellect, they thought very highly of themselves. But the Jews never suffered from poor self-esteem. So although there was some grudging admiration by the Jews for the Greek intellect and some appreciation of their philosophers, and I love this. So impressed were they with the philosopher Aristotle, the Jews claimed he must have been Jewish and not. As for Plato, apparently he received his wisdom from the prophet Jeremiah. Perhaps the most important example of Jewish acquiescence to the Jews was their admiration of the Greek language, which they thought quite beautiful, and for that reason, Greek was the only language they allowed the Torah to be translated into. And this very important event, excuse me, my voice is, took part in Alexander about 300 BC, initially for the benefit of the Jews who were living there, who in a short time had almost lost their own language, Hebrew. At that stage, six representatives from each of the 12 tribes travelled across the empire to Egypt to complete this task. So because most of the Jewish people at that time were speaking Aramaic, which was a leftover from their Babylonian days, and as time went by, Hebrew really became isolated to temple worship, and Greek became the universal language. Now, the Greeks also glorified the beauty of the human body, and the word gymnasium actually comes from the Greek word meaning naked. Naked. Thank you, Tom. Because the athletes competed without clothes, so they were freely exhibiting the beauty of the physical and their prowess over it. Now, the Jews had once considered the Greeks' love of athletics quite immoral. However, so keen were they to become like the Greeks that Menelaus, that's the one that murdered his brother, the priest that murdered his brother, requested from Epiphanes to have a gymnasium built in Jerusalem where competing Jews hid the fact that they were circumcised so that they could appear to be just like the Greeks. So it's really, really being absorbed in to their culture. And then the Greeks had their gods. Well, there's something very interesting about Greek gods. Although the Greeks believed in the departure of the soul at death, overall they were far more interested in the day-to-day living of their lives and looked to their gods for help with the here and now, not the hereafter. For example, if you went to the Agora and you tripped over, well, you probably hadn't appeased a particular god with an appropriate offering and the god was getting back at you. Mm-hmm. If you favoured one god above another, the less favoured may punish you for your rejection. So owing to the fickle nature of gods who had all the worst of human traits, they could be angry with you, they could be jealous, they could be fighting with their siblings and not in a good mood, having an affair with one another, you know, and feeling stressed, and you could well suffer the consequences of these bad moods. So life was very busy in trying to keep the gods happy so that you could live a nice, carefree, safe and happy life. But there was absolutely nothing that was more different than the Jewish concept of God compared to the Greek concepts of their gods. For the Jews, God existed. You didn't need proof. Greeks, if it couldn't be proved, it was folly. Man was made in the image of God, said the Jews. Gods were made in the image of man, said the Greeks. The spiritual world needed to be perfected. The physical world was perfect. God was worshipped even if it caused hardship. Gods were worshipped to avoid hardship. To the Jews, God is worth dying for. God requires his people to live a moral life. No God would expect you to die for him. They do not require morality, only offerings. God is one and invisible. There are many gods. Their likeness is carved in stones. Thoughts and actions are one, faithfulness. Thoughts and actions are separate. Faith is mental and independent to action. And the Greeks were totally perplexed by this strange people, their obsession with a book called Torah, and their unprovable beliefs and irrational rituals. So into this totally different, highly developed, free-thinking, liberal and materialistic society, the Jewish people were plonked. Now, overall, the relationship between Jew and Greek could be described as strained. But sadly, the end result was that the Jews absorbed more from the Greek thinking than the Greeks took from them. And despite such a glaring difference of lifestyle and thinking, the Greek people became, the Greek influence became very strong among Jewish people, and violent disputes arose among the Jews for those who are eager to imbibe Greek culture and thought and to liberalise themselves from some of the restrictions of Jewish law. And as a result of this drive, the Jewish people became fragmented. Some wanted to resist all change and preserve the law of Moses in every respect. They wanted to maintain the traditions of the fathers. They wanted to separate themselves from everyone and every influence. And this party who wanted to separate became known as the Pharisees. That's what the word means, to separate. And this, but strangely enough, this quite noble sort of motive actually in time polarised a group who were seen by Jesus as the religious hypocrites of the day, mm-hmm. keeping the ritual of the law but violating the spirit. And that's pretty much there. The other group were mostly from the families of the high priests or pseudo-high priests, the aristocracy and the wealthy families who had heavily been influenced by Greek culture. They stated that there was no resurrection from the dead as it wasn't mentioned in the Torah. Neither did they believe in the need of repentance, and in keeping with this belief, they often showed no moral restraint. And for them, the blessings of God came from strict adherence to temple life, resulting in blessings of wealth and influence now, in this life. And they soon realised that there was power and kudos to be had in controlling temple worship, and this group became known as the Sadducees. And over time, they developed into a religious body, a political body, I should say, wielding power over the people and even to some degrees over the kings of their prevailing masters, you know. There was another group, a much smaller group, who was so disgusted with these two, they said, we're having nothing to do with this. So they packed themselves up and they went and lived in isolation. And these people were known as the Essenes. And not much is known about them, but they're attributed to preserving some of the sacred scrolls, and in particular the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's some speculation that John the Baptist was one, but there's nothing really to prove that. For the rest of the Jewish individuals scattered across the empire, the Greek influence seeped in varying degrees, and the term Grecians, which we read about in the New Testament, is actually referring to Jews who grew up in Greek society and adopted Greek culture. It's another name for Hellenistic Jews. Now, these divisions among the people were devastating, but there's some evidence that there was some attempts to maintain religious worship for the ordinary Jew living in towns and cities across the empire. And this is seen in the splurge of synagogues, which were built across the empire. And this word, synagogue, is a Greek word meaning meeting place, and it provided a place for study and prayer and company, really. And they're known to have existed as far away as Egypt and Greece and Asia Minor, and the oldest ruins, I think, are about 300 BC. But the great difference in establishing synagogues as a common place was that they took the focus of worship away from the temple, where it had always been in antiquity. And synagogues had no priesthood and they had no offerings. And each synagogue housed the scrolls of the Hebrew scriptures that had most likely been prepared in Egypt and translated into Koine Greek, which is everyday Greek. They were autonomous, they were run by the local community, and they often reflected the different values and aspirations of that community. Nevertheless, they were prevalent throughout the Greek period and provided a facility to Jews throughout the land, a place to counteract the influence of the prevailing society if they wanted to. So, okay, what about the faith, the tenets of Jewish faith? How did they cope with this changing national and political influences? Now, I've got here, so this has actually brought to my attention some years ago by Lloyd, an extract. It's called an extract of Josephus' Discourse to the Greeks Concerning Hades. I don't expect you to read it now. I'm just giving it to you to read as you will. On the back of it, I've summarised it. Yeah. I think this will demonstrate just how far the Jewish understanding of the scriptures had been perverted by the Persian and the Greek Empire. The writing, this particular extract, for centuries it's been attributed to Josephus, and it can be read in the last chapter of his book. However, his authorship's recently been disputed, but for this exercise the author is not important. It's the content, because it's very revealing. It outlines quite carefully the Jewish position regarding the resurrection of the dead. Now remember, the Pharisees and the Sadducees disagreed on the subject of the resurrection of the dead. So Josephus, or whoever it was, in order to address what he believes is the erroneous view of the Greeks, he first outlines the Jewish position. And it's on the back of that sheet, if you want it. And this is how he gets to it. Hades, are we right on there? It's on the screen anyway. Hades, or the place of the demons, is where the souls of both good and bad people go when they die. This is the Jewish belief. The just are led to the right by the angels to a place of light where they enjoy peace and happiness. This is called the bosom of Abraham. The just and the unjust can see each other from a distance, but in case the good person has compassion on the suffering of the bad person, there's this separating abyss which can't be crossed. All souls will stand before Christ for judgment when the time comes when they're all taken back. All souls are confined to the place until God determines the time of resurrection, when all souls will be reunited with their earthly body. The bad will return to the place of darkness forever, never freed by death nor the prayers of interceding friends. It's quite an interesting article, and you can read it at your leisure. Yeah. I'm just showing you that how much had been absorbed into their thinking, right? Mm. He then, Josephus or whoever it was, takes to task the Greeks for what he terms their vain beliefs, as supported by Plato, because they think that when you die you just go to heaven or hell, that there was no resurrection. And their gods, Minos and Rhadamanthus, who were the Greek gods of the underworld, were false, and that the God of Israel was the only true God. This amazing discourse, with very obvious undertones of Zoroastrianism and Greek mythology, demonstrates how far the purity of God's holy word had been corrupted during this silent period. How much the beliefs and the myths of the nations under which Israel found themselves in that period, when there was no prophet in Israel, how much had been infiltrated. Now, I've just attempted to draw a diagram of that belief, right? Here we've got the grave, there's the coffin, there's the... You come down here, you met the waiting room where you're taken to the right or the left. That's the bad one with the fire, and that's the good one. Okay. Now, I've done this because I want to take a brief look at something that's always intrigued me and bothered me, and that is the healing of Legion. And from having a bit of understanding of this, I think I can see a bit more of what's going on. And I've chosen it because I never did fully understand it, and I just think it makes a little bit more sense to me now. Now, we've read that the souls of the dead men were taken to places of darkness and fear via the grave. So they come down here and they've worked over here. But apparently, myth, legend has it, that sometimes some of these souls escaped, and when they escaped they became demons, so they go up there and they inhabit humans. So to the unenlightened mind, a person with a mental illness was thought to have been inhabited by an escaped demon. Thus the expression is possessed of demons. Now in the case of Legion, it appears that a whole group had escaped and they'd made their home in him. Okay. In reality, we know that he was probably suffering from some horrible mental disease. But if you believe this, how would you try and cure Legion? How would you try? If you believe this, how would you try and...
You'd have to get rid of the demon. You'd have to kill the demon, wouldn't you?
And if demons came through here, how would you get them to go home? Well, you'd put them near the grave so that it can come home. Wouldn't you try and get the demons to go back to where they came from?
Mm.
Legion was tied to the tombstone, remember?
Oh.
Yeah. Then, if you wanted to make these demons so uncomfortable that they'd prefer not to be in him but go home, what would you do? You'd torture him. You'd torture him. You'd try and drive the demons back. You'd make it so uncomfortable that the demons would rather go back to where they come from than stay in him.
Uh-huh.
And when the man sees Jesus, when Legion sees Jesus, he says, "Have you come to torture me?" You know. So we find Legion tied to a gravestone in a cemetery, hoping the possessed demons would go home. To me, it now starts to make a bit of sense. And to help them make up their mind to leave him, he was tortured regularly. In reality, what we see and know as barbaric behaviour was probably done with the best interests at heart. And what a demonstration that wrong thinking or wrong doctrine can result in wrong actions.
But that happens now.
It does, yeah. But how did Jesus deal with this situation? This is the bit I find fascinating. Well, I like it, I tell you. Moved with compassion for the plight of this man, both because of his illness and his treatment, Jesus has a dilemma. If Jesus was just to cure Legion, you're cured, put his hand on and he's cured, what would the people think? The people would think the demons have gone back down here. And their superstition would be validated. So how do you cure a person and at the same time cure the people of their belief in a superstition without a protracted argument? Well, if the people thought erratic behaviour in a person was a sign of a demon, how would you demonstrate the demons going somewhere else other than back to Hades? You would show a visual representation of the demons going somewhere else. And what better way than to put them in an animal which has no immortal soul to run back? No escape route back to Hades. And if you're going to pick on an animal, better make sure it's an unclean animal. So that Unlock has got the message that it was an unclean concept.
They didn't dig animals.
No, that's right, they had no animals.
Oh, I like it.
And then let the destruction of the demons be witnessed. Demonstrate complete mastery over the demons and send them to certain death with no way of escape. You can't get back to Hades if you've been destroyed, you know, forever.
Yeah.
For if the demon or the escaped immortal soul dies, that means it wasn't immortal. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
You would not only have cured a sick person, but you would be disproving the presence and power of immortal souls turned demons. And so I think Jesus destroyed the doctrine or the basis of the doctrine of the demons, and he showed the power of God to be greater than any force, real or perceived. He showed God was the author of health, both physical and mental. He destroyed any doctrine of demons when he destroyed the pigs, and he did this without saying a word. And any objective onlooker who considered this spectacle, I think, would in time come to this conclusion. So, at your leisure, go and look at Luke 16, the parable of the rich man, and it's exactly this imagery that's being used. Remember, a parable is not a story, it's not true, but using this prevailing superstition, Jesus condemns the Pharisees for their lack of mercy to the poor and for failing to show compassion. These are the real demons possessing the people, lack of mercy and injustice to one another. But I just found it incredible to think that the Jews in Jesus' time had absorbed so much of this mythology. So let's just start to summarise all the things that happened during the silent period of the Greek Empire and see if we can see the hand of God shaping humanity for the advent of his Son and the spreading of the gospel message across the world. Breaking it down, what we've seen extensions and expanding of the ancient world. We've seen the beginning of the roadworks making travel easier. We've seen the translating of the scriptures into Greek, allowing access to people that had never been able to have it before. Yeah. We saw Greek being the universal language, which was a means by which you could communicate to a broader mass. We see synagogues, which allowed Jews to attend and without being necessarily corrupted by the power and the power controls that were going on in the temple. We've seen a prolonged period of tyranny, bloodshed, deprivation, humiliation. The Jews desperately needed their saviour. We saw internal divisions and splits. Pharisees and Sadducees both became self-interested and self-serving bodies. The people were starving for sound doctrine and sound teaching. We saw the deposing of the Aaronic priesthood. We saw the assimilation of many Jews into the Hellenistic culture, and we saw the contamination and mythology. It's just an incredible mess, quite frankly. So, if all these factors, all of these factors, for better or for worse, played a part in preparing the world for the arrival of God's only Son and the spreading of the gospel message across the known world. These monumental changes impacted on an ancient world and resulted in a totally different environment from any other previous empire. An environment which I believe God prepared as a farmer ploughs a field for the advent of his Son and the gospel message to take root among the Gentiles at the appointed time. Yeah. So where does that leave us? How many times have you heard it said, if God exists, why haven't we had any revelation from him in 2,000 years? I've even heard it said within our own body. I can't understand why God has been so silent. Well, just have a look at this. Just about 70% of time has been silent. Silent years are not unusual nor unproductive, and we ought to take comfort from that. In fact, if we look at the work God was doing in the period leading up to the birth of his Son, I see a remarkable similarity to our day. Let's have a look. Well, if you're going to set a kingdom up on earth, you've got to discover the earth. So what have we been doing for the last 2,000 years? Well, a lot of the earth has been discovered and being populated and being nationalised. We might not have a common language, but we have a common Bible that most people can read in their own language, and that's thanks to the printing press and more recently social media. We have the improvement in transport, which allows people access to remote parts of the earth to preach the gospel. We have a long, long protracted history of wars and despots and cruelty beyond belief. If ever a world needed a redeemer, it's ours. We have an orthodox church system that's imbibed Greek mythology. We have the breakdown of morality and family values as the world adopts pagan cultures under the sophisticated guise of enlightenment. We have religions being used for self-interest, power and control. If ever a world needed a spiritual leader and a teacher of sound doctrine, it's ours. And within our own body, we've had divisions, brother against brother. But we also have meeting halls scattered across the globe where those who want to can go for prayer and study and company. What's God been doing for the last 2,000 years? Well, pretty much the same as he's always been doing in those silent periods. What moral lesson can we gain from these considerations? What can we implement in our life and make us better people, a people prepared for the coming of Jesus? And we're not going to find that answer in the history books or in statistics or in the words of the philosophers. For me, and I really searched this one because I thought I just don't want this to be facts, little, you know, this is what happened. What are we going to take home? How are we going to go home today and think, I want to be better, I want to improve myself? And it took a long while, but eventually it cottoned onto me that if you look in the very first chapters of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, the scene is Rome. The labour is labouring again. The nation, I beg your pardon, is labouring again under a cruel tyrant. It's fragmented. The leaders are corrupt. Did God find the truth when he first sent his son? Can I ask the following quotations to be read out? Who's got number one?
Japheth, Mary's husband, being a just man, was not willing to make Mary a public example, so he purposely put her away secretly.
The first person was Joseph, a just man. A man unlike the Pharisees, who kept the spirit of the law and not the ritual. Number two. Can we ask for number two to be read out, please?
In the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zacharias who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife, Elizabeth, was also a descendant of Aaron. Both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing all the Lord's commands and decrees blamelessly.
Here's a couple. Priest, he's a good priest of the line of Aaron, and both he and his wife were living blamelessly before God. Who's got number three?
Mary said, "My soul glorifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Saviour, for he has been mindful of the humble estate of his servant. From now on, all generations will call me blessed. For the Mighty One has done great things for me. Holy is his name."
Here's a young woman who'd just been given news that would ostracise her from society, probably destroy her relationship with her fiancé, and would cause her pain in the future. And she's utterly undaunted by what lies ahead. "Use me," she said. Number four. Who's got number four?
I have. Yeah. "Now there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon, who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was on him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not die before he had seen the Lord's Messiah."
This is Simeon, and this is an interesting one, because it had been revealed to him. I thought we were talking about silent tones. Just because it's not written in the book doesn't mean that God is not whispering in people's ears personally. This man has been told somehow that he would live to see the birth of Jesus. Number five.
"Truly I tell you, among those born of women, there has not risen anyone greater than John the Baptist. Yet whoever is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than him."
John the Baptist, no greater man, Jesus said, no greater man that was born of woman, preaching the gospel to a perverse generation, a young man of only 30 years of age. Next is, what's the one, two, three, four, six, six.
Luke 2, 36 to 37. "There was also a prophet Anna, the daughter of Penuel of the tribe of Asher. She was very old. She had lived with her husband 7 years after her marriage, and then was a widow until she was 84. She never left the temple, but worshipped night and day, fasting and praying."
She's an elderly lady who worshipped night and day in the temple. Number seven, please.
"The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, 'We have found the Messiah, that is, the Christ.' And he brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, 'You are Simon, son of John. You will be called Cephas,'" which when translated is Peter. Mm. "The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, 'Follow me.' Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Philip found Nathanael and told him, 'We found the one we've found the one Moses wrote about in the law, and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.
So here were a group of young men actively looking for Messiah. And the last one, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, thank you.
From John 12. Now there were some Greeks among those who went up to worship at the festival. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, with a request. Sir, they said, we would like to see Jesus.
Now, I've looked at these people as individuals occasionally, but look at the group. Look, it's a spectrum. It's male and it's female and it's young and it's old and it's married and it's engaged and it's widowed and it's sufferers of disappointment, people that couldn't have children, there's loss of loved ones, there's widows, there's people facing hardship, social isolation. There's men and women preaching Jesus, waiting for Jesus, worshipping Jesus, looking for Jesus. And this microcosm of people, to me, reflect the ever-present remnant of people who can survive all the oppressions of prevailing empires, all the influences of the worlds in which we live, all the negative impacts of divisions and unfairness and fragmentation within our own communities and the world at large, and still be able to live meaningful, pleasing lives to God. This small group of people who survived the onslaught of everything that we've discussed today, they are our heroes, they are our inspiration and our consolation. They are the people that we want to be like. I can see them here today. You know, they are the type of people we want to be. They are proof that God is able to sustain us, nurture us and protect us, teach us, provide for us, comfort us as we face the same types of obstacles that the Jewish people and many people have faced in their silent worlds. All of them who somehow or other managed to navigate their way through mayhem, both within and without their communities, the spiritual survivors that we want to be. And I think that we can take a great deal of comfort from these people who truly represent a spectrum of the remnant that shall be saved, whose faithfulness prevailed the influences of those volatile times. Will he find the faith in the earth when he comes back? Well, let's strive together, really strive together to be one of these remnant, one of these faithful type individuals that Jesus finds waiting and working for him when he comes back. And to that end, let's support each other and love one another. Let's help each other so that he does find in us people living right lives, people who are just, people who love God's word, prayerful people, people occupied in active worship and service to God, in whatever capacity our personal circumstances allow, people looking for the Messiah and waiting patiently and productively for our Lord, whose servants we are.